Tony kicked off mentioning an increase in confidence in the capability and capacity to deliver, but mentioned there was work to be done on productivity. Initially to Tony, and then for the rest of the panel, those positive thinkers in the audience will have noted that despite that we were lagging behind the other sectors, there was a upward trend in construction productivity. How much of this do you think is down to continuity?
A lot.
I think that, I mean, we've heard plenty of evidence here today about, you know, if you have to rebuild skills and capacity every time you start a new project or program, life becomes extraordinarily difficult. I mean, we see this across government in other sectors. We're trying to build submarines, which is quite hard. It's really, really hard if you haven't done it for 7 or 8 or 10 years, whatever the number is, and it literally, you know, have to reskill. So yeah, I think, I mean, I haven't analyzed that productivity curve to answer that question properly, but it's absolutely clear that continuity and certainty and a view of the future, which enables people to plan, to invest in skills, to invest in the future, and for expertise to move from project to project is incredibly important. I just would add, I think some of these projects are doing a fabulous job now of transferring, learning lessons and transferring them. So some of this occurs through formal mechanisms. I think the Olympics set up a great capacity for transferring lessons. Crossrail, I know, has just launched, I was at that event, their Learning Legacy, and that's brilliant, and will make a huge contribution. The best learning legacy, of course, is the people. I mean, lessons learned is a body contact sport. And so being able to transfer people from project to project has been extraordinary. Andrew Wolstenholme's greatest and Terry Morgan's greatest contribution to the learning legacy will be the extraordinary number of highly skilled engineers and project leaders that will come out of that program.
Do you want to lay out your stall and then we'll ask the panel to come back overall? Yeah. Would that be easy?
Okay. Another point that came up through the discussion was that Terry mentioned the role of procurement in stimulating, addressing the skills and diversity needs, and it would be useful to come back to the panel on how much of that do we think that Crossrail has achieved has been down to the leadership they've shown and mandating it in terms of the supply chain. And finally, a point that Andrew brought up was, and in fact, many of the speakers referred to the importance of cross-party political support. And maybe what does the panel think, what do we need to do to ensure that that cross-party political support continues for what are some very, very challenging infrastructure programs in the future?
Thank you very much. Would you like to take the first one, Terry?
Of course I will, but I'm really quite biased about this. On using our procurement power to actually encourage supply side to actually have apprentices, as I said in my speech, to those who are at the front end, who actually are very progressive, who care about their people, they do it quite naturally. But it's also true to say that on a program like Crossrail, there were some of the supply side who said, why bother? We're only going to be here for 4 or 5 years. Why should we train people up and then find we've got to let them go? And I just think that's so short-sighted, to be frank. The truth of the matter, of course, is that whilst we did mandate it, we got a commitment. I mean, if you're a contractor with a £500 million contract in front of you and somebody says, sign it, but you're committing to apprentices, and they say, well, no, we're not, they'd be fools. So they do. But of course, the history is that very often in the past, the client has not followed that through. We at Crossrail have. You're not going to take a contract off somebody who committed to do an apprenticeship program but didn't deliver, but they're on time and within the funding. But at the same time, I think if you have the right leadership, you can actually bring a lot of pressure to bear on those who actually are not making their fair contribution. And of course, the reality is that if you don't do that, then you're going to get a very disorderly market. If we're going to increase the pressure on the infrastructure investment, we need more resources. And my experience is that those companies who invest, who then suddenly find that they're losing their best people because there's a lot of money being moved about in terms of trying to recruit by those who haven't invested in their people. Of course, the net result, it's a lose-lose. Those who invest start thinking, is this worth doing? Some perhaps cut back. And of course, those who haven't invested at all are creating a very disorderly market and actually then run into what I would describe as the risk of then making it quite political. I just think some of the messages I've been talking tonight about sustainability, around skills, about economic benefit, those, if we use the arguments properly, will help reinforce that this doesn't need to be a political debate.
And on that point, across party political support, do you want to add anything, Andrew?
It's very important with major projects that the people who are taking them forward on behalf of the state seek from the outset to generate support across parties, which in our current system, which is very partisan and where there isn't much interchange between government and opposition, happens surprisingly rarely. But where it does happen, it can help to generate support that might otherwise not be available. And if I look at the two big decisions for which I was wholly or partly responsible before 2010, which was Heathrow and HS2, in the case of Heathrow, there was no real attempt at securing cross-party support for the decision itself. Though in defence, I'd say it's because we thought that the opposition was likely to be supporting it anyway. But if there had been a process in place which had actually engaged the opposition, I think it would have made it much harder for the opposition then to have changed its mind over the course of a weekend, which is what happened in that case. In the case of HS2, from the outset, this was planned as with the aim of getting cross-party support, including setting up an arm's-length company, HS2 Limited, which was set up under independent leadership with me as Secretary of State, so I wasn't even wholly committed to the project until they came forward with plans that I regarded as viable, and giving them carte blanche to engage with and to speak to the opposition. And indeed, I didn't actually publish the plans until I'd spoken to the then leader of the opposition and was clear that in principle he would support them because we were coming up to an election. And that was very, very important, because the thing about big infrastructure projects is not good enough just to have support in principle for them. If they have a territorial impact, then as soon as that impact is known, the opportunity for reneging on that support is limitless. And I was only too well aware of the fact that this high-speed line, when it left London, was going to go through the Chilterns, where there were more lawyers per square inch or well-paid lawyers than anywhere in the world. And they weren't mostly supporting my political party, so this was going to be a big and tall order. So seeking to get such support from the outset is important, and as I say, I think an infrastructure commission can play a part in it. The other thing that's clear to me, looking at the experience of Crossrail, though, and actually to some extent HS2 itself, and to some extent also actually, I mean, we haven't talked much about energy, but which is proving really difficult and problematic in terms of getting stability of policy, is engaging in a much more active way than we have in the past this putative strand of regional government that we have in the country. Because if you get projects which are supported at the outset and won't proceed unless they're supported at the outset by local government, and in the case of London, a regional government, and we're having mayors elsewhere, so they'll play an increasingly important role, and central government, you then have two massive stakeholders on the part of the state, the national and local one, bringing things to the party too in terms of political support, but also, in many cases, funding support. And that will give you a much broader political reach as well. In the case of Crossrail, the absolutely critical reason why it wasn't cancelled in 2010 was that London government was supporting it, and as Terry said, also substantially funding it. And that, of course, in 2010 was in the hands of the Conservatives. So you had a Conservative mayor with a Labour government, which was taking forward this project to start with. And then when that changed to a Conservative government, a Conservative mayor was obviously going to invest, had invested his political capital in it, sitting there with a million votes from London, a third funding a third of the cost, which made it much, much harder to cancel than the previous two occasions where it was entirely funded by the government. There was no significant London stake in it, and in one case it wasn't even the London government by that stage because it had been abolished. And that made it much easier to cancel. In the case of HS2, which because there simply weren't mayors in the Midlands and the North to engage in, so I wasn't actually able to plan it in a way that I would have done now in conjunction with city regional mayors. When Crossrail 2 went through a period of serious political jeopardy in the middle of the last parliament, where it looked distinctly possible that my party might turn against it, and the government was getting increasingly worried about the escalating costs, and it went through a period of extremely weak political leadership when the Transport Department was acting actually according to norm since the war, which was changing its Secretary of State once a year, which isn't conducive to long-term planning. I was there for 11 months, so I'm sort of there at the typical end of that spectrum. When it was going through that phase, and it was distinctly possible that the thing could have been really significantly delayed, which could have led to its cancellation, what saved it was that the political leaders of the Midlands and the North, particularly Manchester, which sprung into action because they become increasingly emboldened with the government's devolution agenda and being given a bigger say, and had been engaged in the taking forward of the HS2 project. And when it looked as if it might be cancelled, they sprung into action to an extent that greatly surprised the political leaders in London, particularly the leaders of my party, who hadn't expected this to happen at all, and made it clear that it would be cancelled over their dead body. So I think having a stronger strand of regional government, particularly in our cities, where there's such a big need for infrastructure, modelled on London, which has led the way on this since the creation of the mayoralty in 2000, will not only strengthen infrastructure planning in a kind of technocratic way, but will also broaden the political base of support for these projects and make it much harder to engage in the kind of stop-go, which has been so difficult in the past.